All right, so let's dive into this whole think and act globally thing. We're going to be looking at real-world time management today, which is really all about, like how can we take control of our time and actually like make a difference, both personally and in the community.
Yeah, and it's amazing how many people I talk to feel like they're just drowning in, to-do lists and never-ending demands. They just feel overwhelmed by time.
Yeah, for sure. I feel that way sometimes too, like there's just not enough hours in the day. But this book, Real World Time Management, they actually calculate how much free time we could have.
Right, and that number is really interesting. It's 81 days.
81 days.
81 days.
Whoa.
Yeah, they break it all down. You know, how much time we spend working, sleeping,
Yeah.
even things like, getting dressed or commuting, and the amount of leftover free time. Well, it's pretty shocking. But then they ask this really key question: what are we actually doing with that time?
Yeah. Are we using it to get closer to our goals? Or is it just kind of like slipping away?
Exactly. And that's where I think the think and act locally connection really starts to come in. You know,
Yeah.
if we could harness even a fraction of that free time for local causes or for, helping our neighbors or volunteering,
Yeah.
it's pretty amazing to think about the impact we could have.
Yeah. I mean, wow, that's a lot of potential there. But okay, so how does this book actually help us do that? Help us take control of our time? Because I'll admit, sometimes I feel like it's time that's managing me, not the other way around.
Well, the book focuses on giving you really practical strategies and tools.
Yeah.
And one of the things that stood out to me was the story of this guy, Ide. He's a super successful insurance salesman, and he has this approach where he divides his day into what he calls primary selling time and secondary time.
Okay, so it's all about like prioritizing. Yeah,
Exactly. He
sure.
ruthlessly prioritizes those activities that actually bring in business.
Okay, so he's identified his prime time for closing deals, and he structured his whole day around that. Now, I'm not in sales, but that got me thinking, we all have those peak times, right? Like when we're most productive. So what if we apply that same concept to something like volunteering or even, just spending quality time with family?
I think that's a brilliant application of Aid's approach. It's all about being intentional with our time and making sure that our actions are actually aligned with our values
Yeah.
and what we want to accomplish.
Yeah, for sure. And another thing that this book really stresses is the importance of a to-do list, which I know can be a bit controversial. Some people love them, some people hate them.
Right, but the book makes a really compelling argument for to-do lists, especially when we're thinking about this think and act locally idea.
Okay, so how does that connect?
Well, they argue that a to-do list, when
Yeah.
it's used effectively, can actually be a powerful tool for making a difference in our communities.
Oh, I can see that. If you're trying to organize something like neighborhood cleanup, or maybe you're planning a fundraising event for a local charity, having that to-do list can really help you stay on track and keep things from falling through the cracks.
Exactly. And they actually address a lot of the common excuses that people give for not using to-do lists. Things like, oh, I'm too busy to write everything down, or I'll just remember it.
Yeah.
But then they share all these stories about people who transform their lives and their businesses simply by starting to use a planner and prioritizing their tasks.
So you're telling me that a simple to-do list can help me get more done, even though it kind of feels like one more thing to add to my already overflowing plate?
That's exactly the point. The book argues that it's about getting all those swirling thoughts out of your head and onto paper, which actually frees up mental space to actually focus on the task at hand.
Okay, that makes sense. But even with the to-do list, I often feel completely overwhelmed by just like the sheer volume of things I need to do. So how do you even decide where to start? You know what to tackle first.
Well, the book dives into this with the concept of good enough versus perfect.
Oh, that's a tough one. I'm definitely a bit of a perfectionist
Yeah,
sometimes.
and I think a lot of people can relate to that. But the book argues that sometimes good enough is the best way to go, especially for those more routine or less important tasks, the things that don't necessarily require our full creative energy or attention.
So, how do you know when to strive for excellence and when to just like get it done?
It's a balance, for sure, but the book suggests asking yourself a few key questions. First, is this task necessary? Could it be delegated to someone else? Could it even be eliminated altogether? Second, is it really appropriate for you to be doing it, or is there someone else who might be better suited?
Wow, those are great questions. I think I often just jump into tasks without even thinking about whether they're really the best use of my time or if someone else could handle them more effectively.
It's so easy to fall into that trap. And there are two more questions the book recommends asking. Is this task actually effective? meaning does it align with your overall goals and priorities? And then finally, is there a more efficient way to do it?
So it's about working smarter, not harder.
Exactly. It's about constantly seeking improvement and finding ways to streamline our processes so we can free up more time and energy for the things that truly matter.
And, you know, in the context of think and act locally, that could mean having more time to, you know, volunteer at a local soup kitchen or support local businesses, or just being more present and engaged in our communities.
Absolutely. It's about taking control of our time so we can make a bigger impact in the areas that matter most to us.
Okay, so now I want to talk about this concept of the quiet hour, because I found that really intriguing in the book.
Oh yeah, the quiet hour. This is a really powerful strategy for boosting productivity and achieving deep focus.
I'll admit, when I first read about it, I was a little skeptical. I mean, a whole hour with zero distractions.
Yeah.
It sounded impossible.
Right. It almost sounds too good to be true. But the book claims that a single quiet hour can be as productive as 3 regular hours.
Wait, seriously? How is that even possible?
It's all about eliminating those constant interruptions that we're all bombarded with. You know, the things that derail our focus and drain our energy. So that means no phone calls, no emails, no social media, just you and the task at hand.
That sounds amazing, honestly.
Yeah.
But also kind of terrifying. What if there's an emergency or something?
Well, it definitely takes a shift in mindset. Mm-hmm. But the book suggests that you create a system where your colleagues or your family know not to disturb you during this hour unless it's truly urgent. And you can always set aside a few minutes afterward to catch up on any missed messages or calls.
Okay, that makes me feel a little better.
Yeah.
But I'm still not sure how realistic this is in like a busy office environment.
Oh.
My coworkers are constantly dropping by my desk with questions.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, I get that. It's all about setting boundaries and communicating those boundaries clearly. The book emphasizes the importance of protecting your quiet hour, politely but firmly. So, you know, maybe you close your door, you put up a do not disturb sign, or if you need to, you can even find a quiet spot outside the office.
So it's about taking ownership of our time
and
creating a space where we can really be productive. And I think in the context of think and act locally, I can see how this could be incredibly valuable.
Oh, absolutely. Imagine if you could dedicate that quiet hour to working on a community project, or maybe you're planning a fundraising event, or even just brainstorming ideas for a new local initiative.
Wow, yeah, that's powerful. It's like taking this idea of the quiet hour and extending it outwards to make a positive impact beyond just our own work and personal lives.
Exactly. It's about harnessing the power of focused action to create meaningful change in our communities.
Okay, so now I want to talk about delegation, because this is a key theme that runs throughout the book. And I think it's something a lot of us struggle with, especially when we're trying to balance our personal lives, our work, and our community involvement.
You're right. Delegation can be a real challenge for a lot of people. But the book frames it not just as a way to get things off our plate, but as an opportunity to empower others and build stronger teams.
Yeah, I like that.
Yeah.
It's not about just dumping tasks on other people. Mm-hmm. It's about giving them opportunities to grow and develop their own skills and talents.
Right. And I think that's where the think and act locally connection really shines. Because when we delegate effectively in our workplaces and in our communities, we create this ripple effect of positive change.
Yeah, I can see that. It's like we're building a culture of empowerment and shared responsibility.
Yeah.
But the book also talks about this thing called upward delegation. What exactly is that?
So upward delegation is basically when someone, maybe without even realizing it, tries to delegate their work back up to you.
Oh, no. I've definitely been on the receiving end of that. How can you tell if it's happening?
So the book describes this scenario where someone comes to you with a problem. Let's say it's a challenging task that they're struggling with.
Okay. Yeah, I can definitely see that happening.
And instead of you just offering some guidance or resources, you end up actually taking ownership of the problem yourself. Maybe you offer to help by making a few calls or drafting a document, you know?
Oh, gosh, I've totally done that. I thought I was being helpful. But now that you say it, I realize I was probably just adding to my own workload.
It's such an easy trap to fall into. And the book points out that when you take on someone else's monkey, as they call it, you inadvertently make them dependent on you to solve their problems.
So it's like we're accidentally training people to delegate upwards.
Exactly. The book uses this really brilliant analogy of a monkey jumping from their back to yours, and the monkey doesn't fully transfer until you not only accept the task, but also agree to provide them with progress reports.
Wow, that's such a vivid image. I can almost feel the weight of that monkey on my shoulders.
Right. And the problem is that monkey's just going to keep coming back for more. The person's going to keep checking in, asking for updates, seeking your reassurance, and it just ends up draining more of your time and energy.
Okay, so how do we prevent those monkeys from jumping onto our backs in the first place?
Well, the book offers several strategies, but one of the key tips is to be really clear about who's responsible for what. When someone comes to you with a problem, resist that urge to jump in and take over.
Okay, that makes sense.
Oh.
But what if they genuinely need my help? I don't want to just brush them off.
Right. It's all about finding that balance between offering support and encouraging autonomy. So instead of solving the problem for them, try to guide them towards finding their own solutions.
So it's about empowering them to think critically and take ownership of their own work. And I think that really ties into the think and act locally theme too.
Absolutely. It's about creating a culture where people feel empowered to take initiative and make a difference in their own communities.
Okay, now another thing that can really derail our best efforts to manage our time effectively are those pesky time gobblers. You know, the things that steal our time and attention without us even realizing it.
Oh yes, time gobblers. Those insidious creatures that can wreak havoc on even the most carefully planned schedule.
Yeah, tell me about it. What are some of the most common culprits?
Well, the book identifies several, but some of the biggest offenders are unnecessary meetings, drop-in visitors, and of course, the endless paperwork monster.
Oof, those are all way too familiar. I feel like I spent half my life in meetings that could have just been emails.
Yeah, it's a common complaint. And the book provides some really practical advice for how to tame these time gobblers and reclaim our precious time. So starting with meetings, they suggest setting clear objectives and agendas, establishing time limits, and most importantly, sticking to them.
Okay, that all sounds good in theory, but what if you're in a meeting with someone who just loves to hear themselves talk and has absolutely no regard for time? How do you politely, but firmly, steer things back on course?
Well, that's where assertive communication comes in. The book actually gives you some really helpful phrases you can use in those situations. Things like, I know we're short on time, so let's focus on, or to make sure we cover everything, can we move on to?
Oh, those are good. I'm gonna have to practice those. Now, what about those drop-in visitors? I try to have an open door policy, but sometimes it feels like people are taking advantage of it.
Right. The book acknowledges the value of being accessible to your team, but it also stresses the importance of protecting your time for focused work. So they suggest setting specific hours when your door is truly open and then communicating those hours clearly to your team.
So it's about creating that balance between accessibility and productivity.
Exactly. And even during those designated open door hours, you can use visual cues to signal to people whether you're available for a quick chat or whether you really need to stay focused.
Oh, that's interesting. Like what kind of cues?
Simple things like turning away from your computer to make eye contact when someone approaches. Or maybe keeping your door slightly ajar to indicate that you're available for a brief conversation.
Okay, those are good tips.
Yeah.
I'm going to start implementing those. Now, what about the paperwork monster? I feel like I'm just drowning in paper sometimes.
I hear you. The book offers a ton of advice for managing paperwork, but it all starts with a mindset shift. You have to start viewing paper as an expense.
Okay, what do you mean by that?
So every piece of paper that you handle, that you read, that you file, even if you just glance at it, costs you time and money. So the goal is to minimize the amount of paper that even crosses your desk in the first place.
Okay, that makes sense. But how do you actually do that? I feel like I'm constantly bombarded with reports and memos and all sorts of documents.
Well, the book suggests a multi-pronged approach. First, be ruthless about what you allow into your inbox. Unsubscribe from any unnecessary mailing lists. Delegate tasks whenever possible. And don't be afraid to say no to requests that just aren't aligned with your priorities.
Okay, those are good starting points. But what about the paper that I absolutely have to deal with? Any tips for managing that more efficiently?
Absolutely. So they emphasize the importance of handling each piece of paper only once. So you make a decision about what needs to be done with it. Do you need to act on it? Do you need to file it? Can you delegate it? Or can you just toss it in the recycling bin? And then once you've made that decision, you move on.
That's easier said than done. I tend to let papers pile up on my desk thinking, oh, I'll get to those later.
I know it's tempting, but procrastination is a major time waster. So the book recommends setting aside specific times each day for dealing with paperwork and then really trying to stick to those time blocks as much as possible.
So it's about creating a system and building those good habits.
Exactly. And another helpful tip is to practice skimming and disposing.
Skimming and disposing, what does that mean?
It's about learning to quickly extract the essential information from documents without getting bogged down in unnecessary details. So you practice scanning for key points, highlighting important information, and then getting rid of the paper as soon as you've processed it.
That's a great strategy. I think a lot of us waste time reading things that aren't truly essential.
It's a common trap. And the book provides this great example of this advertising manager for a large business machines division who felt obligated to read every single word of the Wall Street Journal every day.
Oh no, I can already see where this is going.
Of course, he never actually found the time to read it all. So he just had these giant stacks of unread newspapers piling up in his office.
That's painful. I can relate to that feeling of just being completely overwhelmed by information overload.
Right. And the book points out that newspaper editors have a much more pragmatic approach. They clear their desks every day because they know they're just going to be getting a whole new batch of news the next morning.
That's such a great analogy. It's about letting go of the past and focusing on what's truly important in the present moment.
Exactly. And it's a principle that we can apply to all areas of our lives, not just paperwork.
Okay, so now speaking of things that can be totally overwhelming, I think technology deserves its own category when it comes to time management. It's like a double-edged sword.
Absolutely. Technology has the potential to make us so much more efficient, but it can also become a major distraction if we're not careful.
Yeah, for sure. So let's talk about that.
Yeah.
What are some of the biggest technology-related time gobblers?
Well, email is a big one, of course. It's a fantastic tool for communication, but it can easily turn into this black hole that just sucks up our time and attention.
Yeah, tell me about it. I feel like I'm constantly checking my inbox, even when I know there's nothing urgent waiting for me.
It's like a Pavlovian response.
Really?
And the book provides some strategies for taming that email beast and reclaiming control of our inboxes. But first and foremost, it's about setting boundaries. You know, decide how often you're going to check email. Maybe it's twice a day. Maybe it's every hour. And then stick to that schedule as much as possible.
That's good advice.
Yeah.
I think a lot of us feel pressured to be constantly on and responsive, but it's just not sustainable in the long run.
Right. And the book also recommends turning off those email notifications so you're not tempted to check your inbox every time a new message arrives.
Oh, yeah. That's a good one. I'm definitely guilty of getting sidetracked by those little pop-up notifications.
It's so easy to get sucked into that vortex of email. Another helpful tip is to use filters to automatically sort incoming messages into different folders based on priority or sender. That way you can focus on the most important messages first and save the less urgent ones for later.
That's a great strategy. It's about taking control of the technology instead of letting it control us.
Exactly. And they also provide some really practical tips for writing more efficient emails, which I think benefits both the sender and the receiver.
Okay, I'm all ears.
Yeah.
What are some of those tips?
Simple but really powerful technique is to try to put your main message right in the subject line.
Well, that's clever. So instead of just saying meeting reminder, you could say meeting reminder Tuesday 11:12 at 3:4 TM conference room A.
Exactly. That way the recipient can get all the key information at a glance without even having to open the email.
Right. That saves everyone time. And it's especially helpful for people who are, you know, constantly on the go.
Yeah.
Checking email on their phones.
Absolutely. And another tip is to be mindful of using reply all only when it's absolutely necessary. If you're responding to a message that was sent to a large group, ask yourself if everyone on that list really needs to see your reply.
Well, that's a good reminder. I think we've all been in those email chains that just spiral out of control.
It can be so overwhelming. And it's not just about saving time. It's also about respecting people's inboxes and not bombarding them with unnecessary messages.
Yeah, so it's about being more thoughtful and considerate in our digital communications.
Exactly. Now, beyond email, the book also talks about using computers and software more effectively for time management.
Okay, that's a big topic. It seems like there's a new app or program every day that promises to boost our productivity. But it's hard to know which ones are actually helpful.
It's true. The technology landscape is constantly evolving. But the book offers this really timeless principle that I think can help us navigate this ever-changing world. They call it the BYC syndrome.
BYC? What's that stand for?
Because you can.
Because you can.
Exactly. The idea is that just because you can do something with technology doesn't necessarily mean you should.
Oh, I see what you mean. It's like, just because I can add all these fancy graphics and animations to my presentations doesn't mean it's actually going to be more effective or engaging.
Mm-hmm.
Or, you know, just because I can have my calendar synced across all my devices doesn't mean it's the most efficient way for me to manage my time.
Exactly. It's about being really intentional and thoughtful about how we use technology and not just getting caught up in the latest trends or gadgets.
So it's about using technology as a tool to support our goals and priorities.
Yeah.
Rather than letting it become a distraction or a time waster.
Precisely. And I think this really speaks to the think and act locally theme, too.
How so?
Well, Well, I think it's about being mindful of the impact that technology has on our lives and communities, both positive and negative.
Yeah, I like that. It's about using technology to connect with people in meaningful ways to amplify our impact, to create positive change in the world around us.
Exactly. But at the same time, being aware of the potential downsides of technology, you know, things like information overload, digital distractions, the erosion of face-to-face interaction, and finding ways to mitigate those negative impacts.
Right. Those are all really important considerations. It's about finding that healthy balance and using technology in ways that enhance our lives and our communities rather than detract from them.
Absolutely.
Now let's talk about something that I think can be a real time suck, especially if you're someone who travels frequently for work. And that's managing travel time effectively.
Ah, yes. Travel time. It can be a challenge to stay productive and on top of things when you're constantly on the go.
Tell me about it. I feel like I lose so much time to airports and delays and just the general chaos of travel. So what are some of the book's tips for making the most of that travel time?
Well, the book emphasizes the importance of planning ahead and being really strategic about your travel arrangements whenever possible. Try to avoid traveling during those peak hours, you know, like rush hour or those super crowded flights.
Yeah. Easier said than done sometimes, but I get what you mean. You know, rush hour traffic and crowded airports can just eat up so much time.
Exactly. And if you can't avoid those peak travel times, try to build in that extra time into your schedule and then use it productively.
So instead of stressing out in traffic, I could be listening to a podcast or catching up on emails.
Exactly. Or if you're stuck in an airport, you could be reading, working on your laptop, or even just taking a few moments to relax and recharge.
Yeah, those are all great ideas. And I think it speaks to the think and act locally theme as well.
How so? Well, when we're more mindful of our time and we use it effectively, even during those unavoidable travel periods, it frees us up to be more present and engaged when we're back in our communities.
I love that. It's about making the most of every moment, whether we're at home, at work, or on the road. And speaking of being prepared, they also recommend packing strategically for travel, both in terms of what you bring and how you organize it.
Yeah, that's so important. I've definitely had those travel experiences where I'm frantically digging through my suitcase, trying to find one crucial document.
Oh, it's the worst. So they recommend packing light whenever possible, sticking to carry-on luggage to avoid those checked baggage hassles, and then using packing cubes or folders to keep everything organized and easy to find.
Those are all great tips. And I think they apply to our digital luggage as well.
Absolutely. It's about keeping our files and documents and our digital tools organized and accessible, so we can work efficiently no matter where we are.
Yeah, that's so crucial in today's world of remote work and constant connectivity.
It's true. And the book also highlights the importance of actually using travel time for reflection and planning.
Oh, that's interesting. I usually just kind of zone out and watch movies on planes.
I know it can be tempting to just disconnect and relax, but the book suggests that travel time can be a really valuable opportunity to step back from the day-to-day and really think about the bigger picture.
Okay, I'm intrigued. What kind of reflection and planning are we talking about?
It could be anything from reviewing your goals and priorities to brainstorming new ideas or even just journaling about your experiences and insights.
Yeah, those are all great suggestions. I think a lot of us could benefit from having that dedicated time for reflection.
It's true, and it's a practice we can carry over into our daily lives, even when we're not traveling.
And one final thing I wanted to touch on before we wrap up this part of our deep dive is this whole idea of managing time in a globalized world, where we're often working across time zones and dealing with, you know, different cultural norms around time.
Yeah, that adds a whole other layer of complexity. And it's something that more and more people are facing as businesses become increasingly globalized.
So what are some of the book's insights on managing time in that global context?
Well, first and foremost, they emphasize being mindful of time differences and scheduling meetings and calls accordingly. It might seem obvious, but it's easy to overlook when you're juggling multiple time zones.
Yeah, I've definitely been guilty of scheduling a call at a time that's completely unreasonable for someone on the other side of the world.
It happens, and the book also recommends being respectful of those different cultural norms around time.
Okay, that's interesting. Can you give me an example?
Sure. So in some cultures, being late is considered incredibly rude, while in others, a more relaxed approach to time is the norm.
Yeah, that makes sense. I think it's important to be aware of those cultural differences so we can avoid any misunderstandings.
Yeah.
And, you know, ultimately build stronger relationships.
Absolutely. And the book encourages us to embrace the opportunities that globalization presents, you know, being able to connect with people from all over the world and learn from those diverse perspectives.
Yeah, it's like we're expanding our local community to encompass the entire globe.
Exactly. And that brings us right back to the Think and Act Locally theme. It's about recognizing that our actions have ripple effects that extend far beyond our immediate surroundings.
I love that. It's about being mindful global citizens while also staying grounded in our local communities.
Right. And the book shares this really compelling story about Lawrence, who's the CEO of a tech company based in San Francisco. He travels a ton for work. He's only actually in San Francisco itself for about 10 days a month.
Wow, that's a lot of time on the road.
It is. And to manage his time effectively across all those time zones, he's really embraced flexible work. You know, he'll take calls early in the morning or late at night from his home office.
That's impressive, but it also sounds like a challenge.
Yeah.
To maintain a good work-life balance with that kind of schedule.
Yeah. It definitely takes discipline and boundaries. But Lawrence says that having a supportive family and carving out dedicated time for his personal life, even amidst all that travel, is key.
That's inspiring. It's like he's found a way to think and act locally, even while operating on a global stage.
Exactly. And it highlights that it's all about finding those strategies that work for our unique circumstances and priorities, whether we're, you know, globetrotting CEOs or community volunteers.
Well, we've covered a lot of ground already. But before we move on to part two, I want to remind everyone that if you're finding value in this Think and Act Locally deep dive, please consider supporting our show by visiting our website, thinkandactlocally.com/donate. The link is in the show notes. Every contribution helps us keep creating this kind of insightful content.
And we really appreciate your support.
Okay, on to part two. We're going to delve into some more fascinating strategies from real-world time management and explore how they can empower you to make a real difference in your community. Stay tuned.
Okay, so picking up where we left off, one of the things real-world time management really emphasizes is recognizing those sneaky time wasters that, you know, drain our energy and prevent us from achieving our goals.
Okay, so besides all those meetings that could have been emails, what else are we talking about here?
Right, well, they definitely cover those. But the book encourages us to really do a personal time audit. Like, what are your unique time traps, the things that really suck your time?
Yeah, that makes sense. I think we all have those little things that kind of steal our time without us even really noticing.
Exactly. And once we identify them, we can start to develop strategies for minimizing their impact. You know, the book offers a whole bunch of common culprits, but the real power, I think, comes from figuring out what your own personal time wasters are.
Okay, I'm ready to face my time demons. But speaking of facing things, the book also talks about this really interesting exercise called the Time Lab, which is all about exploring our subconscious feelings about time.
Oh, yeah. The Time Lab is fascinating. It helps us uncover all those hidden beliefs and attitudes about time that we might not even be aware of.
Okay, so how does it work? Do I need like a lab coat and a Bunsen burner for this?
No lab coat required. It's actually pretty simple. Basically, you take a list of words that are related to time. Words like past, future, hurry, deadline, that kind of thing. And then you just draw an abstract symbol next to each word that represents your immediate feeling about it.
So it's like a visual representation of our emotional relationship with time.
Exactly. And the book suggests that by paying attention to those subconscious feelings, we can gain some really valuable insights into how we approach time management and even identify areas where we might be self-sabotaging.
Wow, I never thought of it that way. It's like our feelings about time could actually be holding us back from achieving our goals, both personally and in our communities.
That's the idea. Mm. And by bringing those subconscious beliefs to the surface, we can start to challenge them and develop a more positive and empowering relationship with time.
Okay, I'm definitely adding the Time Lab to my to-do list.
Yeah.
But speaking of things that can hold us back, I think stress deserves its own category when it comes to time management. Because when I'm feeling stressed, it's like my brain just goes into overdrive and I can't focus on anything.
I hear you. Stress can be a major drain on our time and energy. It can make it really difficult to focus, to make decisions, to be productive, you know? It's like a time management killer.
Oh, tell me about it. I feel like stress is like a constant companion in today's world. So how does the book suggest that we actually deal with it?
They recommend a really holistic approach that focuses on physical, mental, and emotional well-being.
Okay, so it's not just about, you know, finding ways to relax. It's about taking care of ourselves on all levels.
Exactly. You know, some of the specific things they recommend are getting regular exercise, eating a healthy diet, practicing relaxation techniques like meditation or deep breathing, and of course, making time for hobbies and activities that you genuinely enjoy. You know, the things that bring you joy and help you recharge.
Yeah, those are all great reminders. It's so easy to let those self-care practices slip when we're feeling stressed and overwhelmed. but they're so important for maintaining our energy and resilience, especially if we're trying to make a difference in our communities. You know, we can't pour from an empty cup.
Exactly. And along those lines, the book also emphasizes the importance of setting realistic expectations and learning to say no to commitments that drain our energy or just don't align with our priorities.
That's a tough one for me. I hate saying no, especially when it comes to helping others or, you know, taking on new challenges.
Yeah, it's a common struggle. But the book really makes the argument that saying no is actually a form of self-care, because it allows us to show up more fully for the things that truly matter, including our commitments to our communities.
Okay, so it's not selfish to set boundaries and prioritize our own well-being. It's actually essential if we want to have a lasting impact.
Exactly. We can't pour from an empty cup.
Now, on the flip side of saying no, the book also encourages us to be more proactive about taking action and moving forward, even when we don't feel 100% ready or confident. You know.
Right. That's such an important message. It's about overcoming procrastination and embracing the power of imperfect action.
Yeah, I think a lot of us get stuck in this analysis paralysis, you know, spending way too much time planning and thinking and researching and not enough time actually doing.
It's true. And the book challenges us to really shift from that I'll do it when mindset to an I'm doing it now mindset.
Okay, so it's about taking that first step, even if it's a small one, and then building momentum from there.
Exactly. They share this really great example of this with a sales manager named John, who's developed this really simple but effective system for following up with potential clients after trade shows.
Okay, tell me about John's system. I'm always looking for ways to up my follow-up game.
So at trade shows, he collects all these business cards.
Right.
And then he takes each card and he pastes it onto a separate page in a composition book.
Okay, that seems pretty basic.
Right. But here's the brilliant part. He uses the rest of the page to jot down notes about the person, about their company, their interests, the things that they talked about, you know, whatever's relevant.
Oh, so he's creating this personalized record of each interaction.
Exactly. And he says this really simple system has saved him countless hours and helped him build much stronger relationships.
I love that. It's a good reminder that sometimes the most effective systems are actually the simplest ones.
Absolutely. And it highlights that it's all about finding what works for you and your unique style.
Okay, now another area the book goes into is the importance of our physical workspace and how it can either support or sabotage our time management goals.
Yes, our physical environment can have a huge impact on our productivity and our ability to focus.
So what are some of the book's tips for actually creating a more efficient workspace?
They recommend a few key principles, including minimizing clutter, organizing your desk and files in a way that works for you, and having all the tools and resources you need easily accessible.
Okay, so those all sound like pretty common sense practices. But I think a lot of us struggle to actually maintain an organized workspace.
I know, I do.
It's true. It takes effort and discipline. But the payoff is definitely worth it.
So what are some specific strategies for taming that clutter monster?
So the book suggests regularly decluttering your desk and files, getting rid of anything you don't actually need or use.
Yeah.
And finding a designated home for everything so it's easy to put away when you're done with it.
Yeah, I think a lot of us hold on to things that we don't really need, whether it's physical clutter or, you know, digital files on our computers.
It's true. And the book actually draws this really interesting parallel to those old-fashioned roll-top desks. You know, the ones that were basically like a combination writing space and filing cabinet?
Oh, yeah, I can picture those. So are you saying they were like the original clutter magnets? Well, in a way, yes, because people were just storing everything in one place, which probably wasn't very efficient. And they compare that to how some people use their computers today, you know, just storing every single file and document on their hard drive, which can lead to so much digital clutter.
That's a great analogy. So it's about finding that balance between having everything accessible and keeping things organized and streamlined.
Exactly. And speaking of balance, the book also talks about the importance of using both high-tech and low-tech tools for time management, you know, finding the right mix for your individual needs.
Okay, I'm really intrigued by this high-tech, low-tech balance. Can you give me an example?
Sure. They share the story of Brian, who's a housing manufacturer, and he still uses a simple index card system for storing phone numbers, even though he could easily store them on his computer or phone.
Wait, really? Why does he prefer index cards?
He says he actually finds that it's faster for him to flip through his cards than to search for a number on his computer.
Wow, that's so interesting. I think we often assume that digital is always better. But sometimes those old-fashioned methods can be surprisingly effective.
It's true. And Brian actually has this really clever system for organizing his cards. He calls it the gravity-fed system.
Gravity-fed. Okay, how does that work?
So he puts the cards that he uses most often at the front of the file. So as he uses them, they naturally gravitate to the top.
That's brilliant. It's like a self-organizing system.
Exactly. And it just highlights the importance of finding systems that work for you, whether they're high-tech or low-tech. Now, before we move on, are there any other key time-saving strategies from the book that we should be aware of?
Oh, there are so many. But one that really stood out to me was the idea of trying to finish tasks completely before moving on to the next thing. You know, like really resisting that urge to multitask.
Ah, yes, the myth of multitasking. It makes sense in theory. But I think in reality, we're all guilty of jumping back and forth between different projects sometimes.
Oh, totally. Mm-hmm. But why is that such a bad thing? Doesn't it make us more efficient to kind of juggle multiple things at once?
Well, actually, the book argues that it's quite the opposite. Every time we interrupt a task and come back to it later, we're essentially wasting time and energy getting back up to speed and reorienting ourselves.
So it's about minimizing those unnecessary interruptions.
Yeah.
And finding ways to really stay focused.
Exactly. And they offer a few simple but effective strategies, like setting aside blocks of time for certain types of tasks, turning off distractions like email and social media, and even using visual cues to remind yourself to stay focused.
Yeah, those are all really helpful tips. I think we could all benefit from being more intentional about how we structure our time, especially if we're trying to juggle work, family, and community involvement.
Absolutely. And along those lines, the book also highlights the importance of setting realistic deadlines and breaking down large tasks into smaller, more manageable steps.
That's so important. I know I tend to get overwhelmed by those big daunting projects, and then I just end up procrastinating and delaying even more.
It's a common pattern. But the book emphasizes that by breaking things down into those smaller chunks, we create a sense of momentum and make progress even when we're feeling overwhelmed.
Yeah, I love that. It's like we're taking one step at a time and celebrating those small wins along the way.
Exactly. And it's about being kind to ourselves and not expecting perfection. Now, while we're talking about overcoming challenges, I think it's important to also talk about procrastination, because it's something that we all struggle with at times.
Okay, tell me more about their take on procrastination.
Right.
Why do we do it, and how can we actually stop?
So the book argues that we don't procrastinate just because we're lazy or because we lack willpower. They say we actually procrastinate for really specific reasons, often subconscious ones, that are rooted in our beliefs and our fears.
Oh, that's interesting. So it's not just about willpower. It's about really understanding those underlying motivations behind our procrastination.
Precisely. And they provide a framework for analyzing those motivations and developing strategies for overcoming them.
Okay, I'm hooked. How do we actually get to the root of our procrastination using this framework?
They suggest asking yourself a series of questions, like, what are the potential rewards and penalties of achieving this goal? What are the benefits of actually not achieving it? Am I afraid of failing or not being competent? Is the work itself unpleasant or uninspiring?
Wow. Those are powerful questions. Hmm. I think a lot of us would be surprised by the answers if we took the time to really reflect on them.
It can be very eye-opening. And once you've identified those underlying reasons for your procrastination, you can start to develop strategies to address them.
So it's like turning procrastination from this foe into a teacher almost.
Exactly. It's about using procrastination as an opportunity to learn more about yourself and develop healthier habits. Now, shifting gears a bit, I think it's important to also talk about communication, because clear and concise communication can save us so much time and frustration in the long run.
Oh, absolutely. I've definitely had those communication breakdowns where, you know, a simple conversation turns into this whole email chain or, you know, a series of confusing phone calls. It's such a time waster.
Right. It's a super common problem. And the book really stresses the importance of being clear, concise, and respectful in our communications, both verbally and in writing.
Okay, so let's break that down. What are some practical tips for becoming a more effective communicator?
One technique they recommend is to think journalistically when you're sharing information.
Journalistically, okay. What does that mean?
So it means starting with the most important facts, the who, what, where, when, and why, and then working your way down to the lesser details.
Oh, I see what you mean. It's like that inverted pyramid structure that they teach in journalism school.
Exactly. And it's a technique that can be applied to any form of communication, whether you're writing an email, giving a presentation, or just having a casual conversation.
Yeah, that's a great tip. I think a lot of us have a tendency to bury the lead and get lost in the weeds.
It's true. The book also stresses the importance of being mindful of our audience and tailoring our communication style accordingly.
That makes sense.
Yeah.
You know, what we say and how we say it should depend on who we're talking to.
Absolutely. And it's not just about what we say, it's also about how we listen.
Oh, listening.
Yeah.
That's a skill I think we could all probably improve on.
Right. Active listening is essential for effective communication. And the book provides some really helpful strategies for becoming a better listener.
Okay. I'm all ears. What are some of those strategies?
So they suggest things like giving the speaker your full attention, maintaining eye contact, avoiding distractions, you know, really being present in the moment.
Yeah, I think a lot of us are guilty of half listening while also checking our phones or thinking about a million other things.
It's such a common bad habit. And the book also suggests asking clarifying questions, summarizing what the speaker has said to make sure you understand, and being respectful of their perspective, even if you don't necessarily agree with it.
Yeah, those are all such valuable tips. I think so many communication breakdowns happen simply because people aren't really listening to each other.
It's true. And when we listen attentively and empathetically, it creates a stronger connection and fosters that mutual understanding.
Now, the book also provides some guidance on how to manage communication with our bosses effectively, which I think can be a really tricky area for a lot of people.
Oh, absolutely. It's a crucial skill for anyone who wants to succeed in their careers. And the book really emphasizes the importance of understanding your boss's communication style and preferences.
Okay, that makes sense.
Yeah.
But how do we actually do that? It can be really intimidating to navigate those power dynamics.
Well, they recommend paying attention to how your boss prefers to receive information, whether it's through emails, phone calls, or face-to-face meetings.
Yeah, that's a good point. I think a lot of us just default to our own preferred communication style without really considering the other person's preferences.
It's true. And they also suggest being proactive and keeping your boss informed about your progress on projects and any challenges you might be facing.
Okay, so it's about being a good communicator and keeping them in the loop.
Exactly. And it's also about being assertive in communicating your needs and setting boundaries while also being respectful of their authority.
That's a delicate balance, but I think it's essential for building a healthy working relationship.
Absolutely. And the book even gives you some helpful phrases you can use when you need to kind of push back or negotiate with your boss.
You got me an example.
Sure. So if your boss is asking you to take on something that you simply don't have time for, you might say something like, I'd be happy to help with that, but my current workload is really heavy. Can we talk about priorities and see what can be shifted?
Oh, that's a great way to frame it. It's about being solution-oriented and collaborative.
Yeah.
Which I think are also essential skills for, you know, thinking and acting locally.
I agree. It's about working together to achieve common goals, whether it's in the workplace or in our communities.
Now, one final thing I wanted to touch on is this concept of command presence, which the book highlights as being really important for effective communication.
Oh, yes, command presence. It's about projecting confidence, authority, and credibility in our interactions.
Yeah, I think that's something a lot of people struggle with.
Yeah.
Especially when they're, you know, speaking in front of a group or presenting to a client.
It's true. It can be really intimidating. But the book provides some practical tips for developing that command presence. Things like speaking clearly and concisely, making eye contact, using body language that conveys confidence.
Yeah, those are great reminders.
Yeah.
I think a lot of us get nervous when we're speaking in front of others, and that nervousness can really undermine our message.
Of course, it's totally natural to feel nervous, but the book encourages us to really practice and develop our communication skills, which will ultimately boost our confidence and our effectiveness.
So it's about finding that sweet spot between being authentic and relatable while also commanding respect and attention.
Exactly. And I think that balance is important in any communication setting, whether you're advocating for a cause in your community, leading a team at work, or just having a meaningful conversation with a friend.
Wow, this has been such a great conversation. I feel like I'm already starting to think about time management in a whole new way.
Me too.
Yeah.
It's really not just about, you know, trying to squeeze more tasks into our day. It's about making those conscious choices that align with, you know, what we really value and what's most important to us.
Exactly. And I think that's especially relevant to the Think and Act Locally concept. You know, when we manage our time effectively, it creates that space for us to engage more fully with our communities and, you know, actually make a difference in the lives of others.
Right. It's like we're freeing up not just time, but also energy and mental bandwidth to really focus on those things that matter most.
Exactly. So as we wrap up our deep dive into real-world time management, is there one final takeaway from the book that you think is particularly crucial for our listeners?
You know, one thing that really stuck with me is their emphasis on the importance of actually taking action, which sounds simple enough, But I think so many of us get stuck in those planning and thinking stages. And we never actually get around to doing the things that could truly make a difference.
Oh, I am so guilty of that. It's like I get caught up in this endless cycle of research and preparation, and then I just completely lose momentum.
It's a common trap. But the book really challenges us to embrace the power of imperfect action, to just start somewhere, even if it's messy or imperfect, and trust that, you know, we'll figure things out along the way.
That's such a liberating message. It's like we're giving ourselves permission to experiment, to make mistakes, to learn as we go.
Exactly. And I think that spirit of experimentation and action is really essential for anyone who wants to make a difference in their community. You know, whether it's starting a neighborhood garden or volunteering at a local charity or simply just being a more engaged citizen, it all starts with taking that first step.
So instead of waiting for the perfect moment or, you know, the perfect plan, we just need to dive in and start making things happen.
Precisely. And remember, even those small actions can have a ripple effect. You know, when we show up and we contribute our time and energy, it inspires others to do the same. It creates this sense of collective momentum and possibility.
That's such a powerful reminder. It's like we're all interconnected and our individual actions can contribute to this larger movement of positive change.
Absolutely. And the book actually provides a beautiful example of this with the story of this woman named Sarah, who started a community composting initiative in her neighborhood.
Oh, I love that. Tell me more about Sarah's story.
So it all started because Sarah was just really frustrated by the amount of food waste that she was generating in her own household. You know, she knew that composting was the right thing to do, but it just felt really overwhelming to tackle on her own.
Yeah, I can totally relate to that. Composting always seems so complicated and time consuming.
Right. But instead of getting discouraged, Sarah decided to reach out to her neighbors and see if anyone else was interested in joining forces.
So she turned her individual challenge into this collective effort.
Exactly. And to her surprise, there was a huge amount of interest. People were eager to learn about composting. They just needed a little guidance and support.
That's so inspiring. It shows that even those small, seemingly insignificant actions can have a huge impact when we come together as a community.
Absolutely. And I think Sarah's story is a perfect example of thinking and acting locally. You know, she identified a problem in her own life, and then she used that as a catalyst for creating positive change in her community.
And I bet that composting initiative not only reduced food waste, but it also, you know, brought people together and fostered a sense of connection and shared purpose.
I wouldn't be surprised. It's amazing how often those think and act locally efforts end up having, you know, multiple positive benefits, both for individuals and for the community as a whole.
So what does all of this mean for you, our listeners? We've covered a lot of ground in this deep dive, but I think the most important takeaway is this. Time is our most valuable resource. And how we choose to use it is ultimately a reflection of our values and priorities.
That's beautifully said. It's not about being perfect or achieving some mythical level of productivity. It's about making those conscious choices that align with, you know, who we want to be and the kind of impact we want to have on the world around us.
And if this deep dive has inspired you to think and act locally in new and exciting ways, we would love to hear from you. Share your ideas, your challenges, your successes with us on our website. thinkandactlocally.com/donate. The link is in the show notes. And if you're enjoying our show and you're finding value in these deep dives, please consider supporting us with a donation. Every contribution helps us keep creating this kind of insightful content and bringing it to a wider audience.
We really appreciate your support.
Okay, folks, that wraps up our deep dive into real-world time management for a more fulfilling life and a more vibrant community.
Yeah.
Until next time, remember to be present, be intentional, and be the change you want to see in the world.